Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we're here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Community Radio is radio like no other. You can actually hear us on this radio station, and what could be better than that? Well, March isn't done with this yet. It looks like we've got some winter ahead, so I hope you're all well and warm and inside looking out.
Still so, yes, sitting by the wood stove.
Yeah, not a bad day for that. Also, I want to take this opportunity to say Happy Pi Day, folks. It is pi, as in P-I, the long number, 3.14. Any reason to celebrate. And for those who like big numbers and fancy numbers, 3.14 is near and dear to lots of people's heart. And because it's March 14th, it's also 3/14th. So have yourself a slice of pie.
Oh,
did you just get that, Donna?
Oh, yes, I did. Sorry.
It's a food-related thing, but it also connects us to the bigger world. Happy Pie Day.
Yes, even the New York Times had a front page, it's Pie Day with three pie recipes. So,
and see, they get down to the nitty-gritty, real stuff, the real pie. Yeah. Good. So today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we're going to talk about the business of feeding people, the business of restaurants. For many of us, eating means not cooking ourselves, but going out and have other people do it for us. We visit restaurants, we go to the deli food counter, we order takeout, and now there's all kinds of possibilities. Let's look at what it takes to keep a restaurant up and running, and let's also look at the impact of COVID-19 and the new trends in business. Joining us today on our table, at our table, is Peter Beekler. He calls himself a food systems professional, which he is, with more than a decade of experience in a variety of food and farming industries. He has experience in a lot of different things. Developed justice and development oriented NGO work and consumer-oriented positions in the hospitality industry. He's motivated to help change the global food system to help alleviate poverty, provide safe food sources, revitalize rural economies, and do this while promoting economic, social, and environmental justice. Welcome to our table, Peter Beekler.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here with you.
Good.
Well, I also want to say that Peter is a graduate of the Cornell, what's it called, Hotel and Restaurant?
Yeah, Cornell University School of Hotel Administration.
There you go. Which is, by the way, the finest school in the world for that sort of thing. It is really, really well known. And then you went on and got another degree from Tufts. Give us the details on that one.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So I have a master's from Tufts University. There's Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. My concentration is on agricultural and food policy specifically. So more on the production side of policy.
And Peter, you grew up in Ames, right?
I did. Yeah. So I am local to Ames, moved away for college, but recently moved back in 2020, and have been here for almost 3 years now.
So here's how I met Peter. Fred Kirschenman very generously had taken me to Stone Barns, the Blue Hill restaurant in the, it's like, you know, the best restaurant in the U.S. practically.
And in where is it?
It's in just outside of New York City on the old Rockefeller estate. It is beautiful. It's magnificent. It's that Dan Barber is the chef and he bills himself as the poster child to the farm to table culinary world, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sitting at the bar with Fred and his wife, Carolyn, and, Peter is there, and we're just chatting away, and all of a sudden, it comes up that he's from Ames, and that I know his parents, and it's like, oh my goodness, it was just kind of one of those, small world moments. So, how did you arrive at Stone Barns?
It was a kind of a, I don't know, just kind of happened. I was looking for an internship between my sophomore and junior year of college, and applied to an apprenticeship program that Stone Barns or Blue House Stone Barns has, and I worked for them for 6 months in between my freshman and sophomore and junior year. Did all of the front of house positions within the restaurant, worked on the farm there as well, learned a lot of really valuable lessons, and then I had the opportunity to come back to them after I had graduated and done some other things, and worked with them from 2015 to 2018. I worked for them in the event management capacity.
Must have been a lot of good experience.
Yeah, you've had lots of good experiences. Matter of fact, you just got back from 5 weeks of traveling, and this is kind of all food related. Just kind of give us a quick rundown of where you've been recently.
Sure. I had the opportunity to take a trip this past month, and I wanted to go to Southeast Asia. I used to live in Cambodia for a while, and had always wanted to go back, was planning to go back in 2020.
And what did you do in Cambodia originally?
I worked for a nonprofit, an NGO that does hospitality vocational training for young adults. They're usually between 19 and 25. The NGO, they work with the local restaurants and hotels in the town of Siem Reap, which is a big tourist town, helping these students who are often coming from the surrounding villages who haven't had the economic opportunity in those villages to advance their lives. They help them move to the city and help them find jobs in restaurants and hotels and everything. So worked for them for a while back in 2013 and 14. Made a lot of friends there and had wanted to go back years ago. I helped open a training cafe for the nonprofit when I was there previously, and wanted to go back to see this cafe finally be open and fully running. Hadn't had the opportunity to do so until this past month. Went back and got to see that. Spent some time in Vietnam with a very good friend of mine. Got to do a lot of food touring in Vietnam, lots in Cambodia. Popped over to London for a little bit to see a friend there who works in hotels. Did a little food touring around there, and then ended up in New York City, back in my old neck of the woods in New York City, to check out kind of the New York restaurant scene after, in a post-COVID kind of environment.
So you're going to give us a complete global perspective here.
Yeah.
I wanted to start with explaining to our audience that Noma, which is considered the best restaurant in the world by many, which is in Copenhagen. So that restaurant, which uses hyper-local produce and has been through all kinds of, they closed for a while and built a whole new facility and this, that, and the other. Then they have announced recently that they are closing in a year because, quote, they are not sustainable, right? So tell me what you think about this story and how it's impacted everybody else.
Sure. The chef Rene Redzepi, often seen as one of, the premier chefs in the world, mm-hmm. and very innovative, a true, champion of, I would call him a champion of underutilized ingredients and
local things. Completely.
Yeah, local ingredients, lots of things that
has a great fermentation book because they've
very, very, very forward-thinking, you know, a really great, great advocate for the restaurant world. And he, you know, took a, he took a look at his operation, post-COVID. I mean, there was a great New York Times article talking about his decision, and just kind of looking at, you know, how intense, how laborious and laborious the fine dining world is, and what it takes to run a restaurant like that, what it takes to ask of people to run a restaurant like that, and just not only from like a financial standpoint. I mean, this is a restaurant that has, you know, consistently, you know, is around $500 per person for a meal there.
And they're, you know, completely booked all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, so they're at the maximum, like, people, financial yield, and it still doesn't work.
Yeah, right. And it still doesn't work. And it's still, you know, and I know a financial decision making is definitely part of it, but he was also looking, you know, socially at his staff and considering, you know, what he's asking of interns, of apprentices, what he's asking of people that are coming there to do stages for 3 months.
You want to explain to our audience about this whole apprentice and stage system and how it works?
Yeah, so in very higher end of restaurants, it's very common for, you know, whether you're a culinary student at one of these culinary schools, or you just graduated from them. But it's very common for young chefs or cooks to take internships or stagiaires, which are a shorter length internship, about 3 months usually. But it's very common for them to take these positions.
And they're often unpaid, right?
Often unpaid, or very small stipends, or there's some other non-monetary benefit that the restaurant is providing for, you know, this labor that they are providing. So in the case of Noma, their stagiaires who work for 3 months, Noma was sponsoring their visa, their work visa, to work in Denmark for, you know, those 3 months. But then all other expenses, living expenses, were on that stage for those 3 months.
Right. So often young people who have finished culinary school, and it's really competitive to get these stages at the top restaurants, you know, and it's great on your resume, and, oh, I worked with Chef so-and-so, and it's a hot thing. But you actually end up often, you have to, not only have you paid for culinary school, then you have to, you don't pay the restaurant for the stage, but you have to pay your living expenses while you're in a foreign country. Often it's quite complicated and quite demanding.
Right. And honestly, if we're talking about it, it's only available to people who come from a place of privilege. You know, somebody who can afford to do this for 3 months and do that, or they're doing it at great personal sacrifice to their own finances or anything. And, you know, for a while, I think, and for a very long time, not a while, for a very long time, it was kind of seen as okay in the restaurant industry, because it was seen as resume building, seen as kind of an investment in, you know, getting yourself further up in, you know, in the industry. But, you know, in this new climate and this new employment climate and just like social climate, I think a lot of restaurants are really taking a step back and looking at this with pressure from, you know, their labor force, saying, you know, this isn't okay. Like, we are providing labor for you, and we should be compensated justly for that labor. And I think that's a good movement. I think it's necessary, but it is going to challenge, you know, the existing paradigm of fine dining restaurants, and that they're going to have to start paying their, you know, the labor that they've relied on to do that. And what it's going to come down to is maybe fine dining is not sustainable in that regard. Maybe they can't afford to pay all this staff. Maybe they can't afford to ask this of their staff, you know, to do this number of hours, you know, we have overtime laws here in this country, which, you know, restaurants do not want to pay overtime. So there's just a lot of considerations for a lot of restaurants now, looking at this new labor environment and, you know, having to adjust their operations to make sure that we are paying people.
Well, I know the dining public finds it hard to understand how one could pay $500 for a meal at a restaurant, and then it turns out that the cost of the meal is not enough to actually mm-hmm. make the restaurant a profitable business if they were paying mm-hmm. everyone a living wage and or health insurance, for example, with food service industry all over has become a major, major problem. Because for years, I started out before I was a chef. I did front end of the house waitressing and stuff like that, you know, and it used to be, well, in the 60s and 70s, it worked because the tips that you were paid actually were cash. They were usually not declared to the IRS, or maybe only a tiny bit, and they went directly into your pocket, which made it a reasonable way to work. But then over time, first of all, the IRS stepped in and said, no, we got to keep track of the tips. You got to pay now. And you have to understand that in those days, and I think till this day, the hourly minimum wage, which is not very high to begin with. What is it? Still $7 or something ridiculous, not livable. But for restaurant workers who are tipped, it's still in the $2 per hour range.
Yeah, $2.36 or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, so one does not live on wages, no. at least in the front of the house.
Right.
So tipping the only reason people are willing to be servers and waitresses and waiters is because of tipping. So when the IRS kind of put a dent in that, it made it a less attractive job in a lot of ways. And also then restaurants began doing a thing which is completely justifiable, that the waiters and waitresses would pool their tips. Then a certain percent would go to the busboys, sometimes to the dishwashers. And so it was the tipping became a structure that actually paid basically certain kinds of wages in the restaurant industry, because the restaurant industry wasn't lucrative enough to pay decent wages. So now all of this is completely up in the air, and people are unwilling. With our very low unemployment rate, restaurants are having a hard time attracting good labor. So what's going on, Peter?
A lot of it is, it is a workers' economy right now, mm-hmm. Which, you know, it's not a bad thing to be able to, for workers to be able to leverage. But what you run into in the restaurant industry specifically is you kind of have this dichotomy between independent restaurants. So these are restaurants that are owned, you know, independently. They may have, you know, the owners may have one or two or maybe three restaurants, but, you know, quite independent, versus some of these larger chain environments. So, like, very big right now are fast casual restaurants. They're your typical, you know, franchise kind of model.
Which we have a lot of in Ames.
Yes, which we have a lot of in Ames, which there is, you know, there's quite a big corporate backing there, and it's kind of a shared pool of money for the corporation. So, you know, what you have is McDonald's being able to pay $15 an hour for someone to work in their restaurant, you know, $12, $15 an hour for someone to work in their restaurant, whereas you have an independent restaurant who can't match that wage. They cannot. I mean, it just does not make sense for their books to match that wage. So with this, like, limited pool of workers, you know, they're going to go work for the higher paying restaurant.
Well, and you can't blame them.
You know, no, you can't. No. And, you know, they're going to go work where they're going to make more money. And I think what a lot of people don't quite understand about restaurants, you know, P&L statement, their profit and loss statement, is a lot of restaurants are operating on a 5% profit, and that's about it. You know, it's like 3 to 5% is their bottom line. You know, we often learned in school that, you know, prime cost, which is your cost of your goods, plus your labor costs, is usually about 60% of your revenue.
If you're good at it.
If you're good at it, yes. So yep. 60 to 65% of your revenue. That leaves you 40% to pay for overhead.
Which for some restaurants is, I mean, real estate.
Yeah.
You know, they have to be posh and clean and beautiful. And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, where we see a lot of that going is to rental. So a lot of people don't understand that a lot of restaurants rent their space. They don't own the space that they're in. They are renting, and these are very high-dollar retail rental spots. So, you know, they have owners who are asking exorbitant, and you see this all the time in New York City, in larger cities. Mm-hmm. Even in small college towns like ours, retail is the rental spots are very expensive, and if you want, and I mean, this has been true forever, restaurants are all about location, location, location. You want to be in a prime spot, you're going to pay prime rental price.
And not only that, when you're renting this space, it's up to the restaurant to go in and furnish it, including correct. Building out a kitchen, which building out a commercial kitchen, we're talking, you know, could easily hit $500,000 dollars, even in a town like Ames.
Correct, yeah.
So big investment.
Huge investment. Yeah. So it is, you know, it isn't as simple as saying, well, restaurants just need to pay more. I do think restaurants do need to pay more. It's where is that money going to, like, where are we going to find that money? It's either going to be found by raising prices, which people don't want to spend more on food. It's something I get very frustrated with. But, you know, and it's, you know, a similar argument to the tipping argument. People are, you know, they don't want to, what's the point of tipping? Why are we tipping? Well, if you don't tip, then you're going to see an increase in your food cost. Like your price of your meal will increase because the restaurant has no choice but to increase the price of their food to adjust for paying a higher wage for their work.
Well, I have been, not that I'm out and traveling and eating at fancy restaurants, but I have been, of course, reading that a lot of places are now, of course, adding in the tipping to the bill. Mm-hmm. So it's not like voluntary. And they're also adding, so you've got your basically 20% for the service. And they're also adding another 20% to pay for health care for the staff, which means you get your bill, so you've got your prices on the menu, and then you've got an extra 40% added. And mm-hmm. people just have to pay it if they want to go out.
Yeah.
Did you see some of that while you were traveling?
I've seen it's been interesting watching this dynamic. I mean, this was very popular about, you know, I mean, with Danny Meyer's, what did he call it? Service Included, mm-hmm. his initiative that he started in New York City. This was probably about 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. He has since gotten rid of that in his restaurants. But
well, because it only is going to work if a lot of restaurants do it, you know, and then it
correct.
Becomes.
Yeah. And, but, you know, it's kind of that sticker shock at the end of the meal. I think a lot of restaurateurs are hesitant to do this because, you know, the end of the meal is what people remember the most. And if the end of the meal is you getting upset because you have an extra 40% on your ticket, you know, I don't know if that's going to be a really large trend moving forward. I think a lot of restaurants are really hesitant to do that. So.
Have you gone out? I don't know about the audience. I haven't been out to eat a lot lately. I wonder why. Things have changed since we got hit hard by the COVID. The COVID pandemic came through, and we're still kind of dealing with that. Things are shifting around. We're thinking about different ways to pay a living wage. We're talking to Peter Buechler, and we will come back. I want to mention this is KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. And since we've got St. Patty's Day coming up, a little bit of a tune called The Irish American Reel. Welcome back. You're listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about the restaurant business. Today, we forget there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. We're talking to Peter Beekler. I have a question, Peter. We're talking about tipping, and it rubs people all sorts of different ways. Why should people have to be tipped? But do you talk about the people in the front of the house, the servers getting tipped? Chefs ever get tipped?
That's a very contentious question within the restaurant industry.
Right. What's your opinion, yeah. sir?
You know, the initiative behind a lot of, you know, and this was, again, as I was saying, like, this was a very strong initiative about 5 years ago, about the either getting rid of tipping or service included, which is, you know, considered a service charge instead of a gratuity. There's some legal language there that has to be figured out by restaurants, you know, gratuity versus a service charge. So a lot of restaurants were trying to move towards including a service charge, and that service charge would be pooled across the entire house. So that front of house, you know, wait staff, servers, bartenders, all the way down, you know,
dishwashers, busboys,
porters, yeah. dishwashers, yeah, all of that. You know, that was to help, you know, cover the wages for the entire house. And it was kind of like, you know, rising tides lift all ships, that, you know, by having the service charge, everybody in the house would be getting a pay, or, well, not, you know, everybody in the house would be have more equal pay, is what I should say. Huh. The issue that a lot of restaurants ran into is that meant a pay cut for a lot of the servers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the servers were actually, you know, seeing a decline in their wages, their earned wages, because they weren't collecting all of the tip that was coming in for the restaurant. So there's been a big pushback on those types of initiatives, just because, you know, it is there, you're losing staff because they're realizing that they're not going to make as much, for it not being a tipped position, you know.
Well, and the thing is with the service, the waiter or waitress is the contact person with
right.
the customer. So you need a certain, you know, certain level of experience to actually be good at that.
Right.
Service is really, right. the quality of the service is a mark of the kind of restaurant that you're right. in.
And I guess we need to have, like, within the restaurant industry, we need to have a larger discussion of, you know, what is the point of tipping? Is the point of tipping to reward good service? Or is the point of tipping to help cover our labor costs? It's like, that's the real,
yeah, yeah,
I mean, that's
yeah.
the real question that we're asking, is like, you know, is tipping meant for good service? Is it a reward for good service? Or are we really trying to just find a way that the customer is paying for our labor costs without doing things that a normal business would do, i.e. increase prices so that your revenue covers the cost of your labor, your increased labor costs. So, you know, that is, and I think that's where a lot of people, like, you know, consumers, when they come into this conversation, I think that's why they're so hesitant to pay service charges or the required tipping amount, because they've been conditioned over years to think that tipping is a reward for good service, whereas restaurant professionals see it as, no, that is my wage. That is paying me for doing my job.
Yeah, so, this is a conversation that has not been had for a long time and needs to be.
Right.
Yeah, a lot has to be said for what we expect when we go. There's something about, it doesn't happen in many other things that we pay for on a daily basis, but somehow when we go out to restaurants, it's like, oh, we are at the table and all the rest of these folks are servants, as in, I think a lot of our past history of the people that serve somehow are, they ought to be glad for whatever little thing we give them. I want to mention again, Donna mentioned this before, I ran across an editorial called, that says, that tipping is not a reward, it's an insult. And the idea of that having to make up minimum wage, except in some cases, minimum wage is not the
No, that's
dollars.
What we were saying. It's $2.36 or something
What
that.
Is it?
Per hour.
Yeah, per hour. It's $2.13 an hour for tipped wages. I don't know. I have to hustle pretty hard to make that up per hour. That doesn't sound very fair to me. Also, I want to mention that tipping is not universally done around the globe.
This is an American institution.
Yeah.
Like, I can remember when I was a waitress and you would get, this was in Los Angeles, you'd get a lot of international customers, particularly Europeans who would come in, and they did not come from a culture where tipping was happening, and you would always groan when you would get these kinds of tourists because you knew they probably were not aware that tipping was customary and they weren't going to leave you a tip. You know, they just, it wasn't malicious. They simply didn't know because it's a big cultural difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting. I'm glad you brought this up. I listened to a very, very good podcast recently on tipping culture in America and where it came from. And when America was founded, tipping was not seen as a very American thing. It was not egalitarian. It was not, it was not in line with the ideals of what our country was founded on. But tipping came about both at the same time that slavery was outlawed in this country.
Aha.
And black people were starting to enter the workforce.
And a lot in food service.
A lot in food service. It was a way to pay black people slave wages, and past that, the server mentality on, like, the servant mentality onto black people who were working in these, like, food service positions. And simultaneously, as that was happening, actually tipping was more common in Europe during the 1860s.
Huh.
So a lot of European immigrants who were coming into the country post-Civil War had been conditioned to tip and were, you know, some of these more middle-class immigrants that were coming over were tipping service staff, and it became much more common after the Civil War. But since Europe has had its own, revolution in a sense, and, you know, they do have the more egalitarian mentality over there, and that, like, we should pay servers a living wage, and therefore many people in Europe don't tip. It's not part of their culture anymore. So it's interesting how those historical dynamics have, like, shifted our thought process on tipping.
Well, so, and then where does the new latest restaurant industry issue with healthcare. Obviously, people are used to working in restaurants, at least the non-franchise, non-corporate restaurants. Mm-hmm. I never had healthcare when I worked in restaurants. None. Zero. Zip.
And yes. You often mentioned that, well, besides a lot of people going in and out, which is all sorts of things happening, healthcare is kind of a... would be a good thing because kitchens are a dangerous place to work.
Yes, as I like to say, that the door on the kitchen at Esalen Institute used to say, danger, we play with fire and carry sharp knives in here.
Yeah. I mean, I think in this new climate, we're attracting, workers is getting harder and harder. I think a lot of restaurants are including, we're starting to see more restaurants include healthcare as a benefit. That is going to increase their costs. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I think it's going to become a minimum standard at some point. Restaurants can't escape that any longer.
Like on the big corporate chains, does McDonald's provide healthcare for their workers?
I'm not 100% sure about that. I've seen recently a lot of those, the corporate chain, the fast casual chains, they are including additional benefits. Maybe it's not healthcare. I know some restaurants are now doing they provide, money for their workers to work on a degree at some point. So there are restaurants are now having to do a lot more
to attract workers.
Which is good. I think that's great. Where we run into the issue is who's able to compete on that level. We're talking about multi-unit, fast casual, franchise,
corporate Panera, for example, or
right. Yeah. They can spread their costs off over multiple units. Where you really run into the issue is, these small independent restaurants that are trying to compete. Which we all love. Like, everybody loves going to those restaurants. They have, the most charm, the most diversity in what they offer. But as consumers, we need to start thinking about if we value those restaurants, we need to start being able to open up our wallets a little bit more to support those restaurants.
Well, after all, eating out is a privilege. It's not like it's a requirement in life. Mm-hmm. You can go to the grocery store shop and cook it yourself, right? However humble it may be. But this also brings up, what happened to the restaurant industry during COVID? Mm-hmm. Shocker.
It was hard. I was out of the restaurant industry at the time that COVID hit. I was working on my graduate degree at that time. But that March when things started to really shut down in 2020, it was hard to watch a lot of my friends who had very secure jobs or what they thought were secure jobs be laid off. And so I just recently read a statistic that in March alone, I think half of the workforce that worked in restaurants were laid off in March, and just mass layoffs. It's taken a while to recover from that, and we haven't fully recovered. Countless independent restaurants closed their doors. I was recently in New York City and just walking around the city and seeing restaurants that I used to go to be shuttered without anything else being in there was really, just really sad to see. And these were very, very successful restaurants that just couldn't make it through the pandemic. A lot of them had to close because of they couldn't afford their real estate. They couldn't afford, they had no revenue coming in, or they weren't able to adapt and move to a takeout model or make that work for them.
And the government bailout of the restaurant industry was really uneven, and I've heard so many complaints about who got the money and why. And
right. Yeah. And the paycheck, the PPP program, the Paycheck Protection Program, was really intended to help these restaurants pay their staff, which is really important. absolutely. Like, that helped keep kind of the staff afloat during that time. But a lot of, I mean, I have friends, I have a good friend who ran two restaurants in Nashville all through the pandemic. And she, you know, she really, like, her restaurant even lobbied really hard to try to get, you know, authorization to be able to use some of these pay protection program funds, or their paycheck protection program funds, to help cover overhead costs just to keep the restaurant afloat. Like, there weren't, because there was not enough revenue coming in to keep the restaurant afloat.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, people got really creative too. I mean, you know, switching over to a, you know, completely takeout model, you know, getting on the takeout apps. I'll be interested to see where that goes, if all of these restaurants continue with their takeout menu program. It's very expensive to run. You're often paying a lot of fees to these,
you know, deliveries,
delivery services, DoorDash, whatever. And so it'll be interesting to see how long that stays post, you know, post this pandemic, that, you know, some restaurants just are going to be like, this isn't worth it for us anymore. Like, if you want to eat our food, come to our restaurant. Like,
you're listening to
down, have a meal with us.
Good. You are listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. Well, Peter Beeklin, you've been talking about all this stuff happening around the world and in the restaurant business. There's a lot going on. We forget. There is a lot going on behind the scenes. And yet, as customers, we ask for things like, on top of everything else, the asking for the locally produced organic food, that's got to add to the cost too. My goodness.
Well, and food costs for everything. In case you haven't noticed at the grocery store, everybody is paying more for food.
Ha. Huh. Well, also, let's get you back to Ames, Peter. You have moved back to Ames for many reasons, but one is that your family has something called Lawyer's Little House Bed and Breakfast, and that has a lot of good things going on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So my family operates a bed and breakfast on our farm just north and east of Ames.
Right on the Skunk River, on the beautiful
right
Skunk
the
River.
Yeah, it's beautiful out here. It's a very rural setting. We are in an old, so the the bed and breakfast is an old farmhouse, or well, sort of farmhouse, but it's an old 1950s house that has very unique woodworking and carvings that were, the story of the house is very beautiful, and it was originally built by Dr. Austin and Loya Getz back in the 1950s. Those were neighbors of my family's for, you know, that family was neighbors of my family for over 40 years. And they approached us about purchasing the farm and the house in 2015. And we opened up Loya's Little House Bed and Breakfast in 2016. We have four rooms. It's a quite a large, sprawling house. We can accommodate up to 16 guests at one time. We have a conference center, where we can do events, yeah, it's just a beautifully landscaped property with a lot of really great opportunities. So we love being here. We love, being part of the local Ames community and inviting people to check out Ames. So.
Well, welcome back to the community. It's good to have you here. And since it is a bed and breakfast, do you get to make breakfast, Peter? Tell me about the kind of breakfast you like to make.
Sure, yeah. You know, I am someone who likes to be creative in the kitchen and to do lots of different things. I often do not want to cook the same breakfast over and over again. So
it's not bacon and eggs and toast.
But if you want that, I can do that, and I can do it really well. But I try to incorporate some things that are unique for me and that have a lot of meaning for me personally as a cook and as someone who's been able to travel a lot and, you know, taste a lot of cuisines and learn how to cook a lot of cuisines from around the world. I try to incorporate a lot of that into my cooking.
Give us some examples.
I'm currently working on a recipe, kind of an updated recipe for congee. Congee is a traditional traditional Chinese rice porridge, often eaten at breakfast time. And there's different ways to dress it up and make it, you know, a little bit more breakfasty for kind of a Western palate. So I'm currently working on something like that. I'll be rolling that out here, trying to test it on some of our more regular guests
So the congee itself is you just cook the rice until it dissolves to kind of oatmeal consistency, and then then there are the add-ins, you know, a little piece of pork or some bacon and some scallions and the, you know, so you
like
personalize
eggs
it.
And it's like very and that's kind of inspired like my recent travels to Asia. I was just in Asia for a few weeks and things like that. I love to do shakshuka for guests. Which is a traditional Middle Eastern tomato stew that you poach eggs in. I just like to travel around the world with what I cook here at the bed and breakfast. It's been nice being able to experiment and do that with the breakfast food here. So.
Yeah, and you have a very nice kitchen to cook in out there.
Yeah, it is quite nice. Yeah.
Well, also on your resume that I sort of looked up here, the term rural economic development and sustainability shows up a lot, and it sounds like you can do a lot of hands-on things to right now, especially since do you use ingredients that are grown on your family farm?
Yes, absolutely. I'm very anxious to get outside and start the garden. I have a 12,000 square foot garden that I produce food on every year.
And plus cattle on the farm.
Plus cattle.
You have your own beef.
Plus cattle, beef. I think we're going to get a few pigs this year. Chickens, turkeys, all sorts of things that we're working on this year and cooking up. My brother does the livestock management on the farm, so he's kind of in charge of all the animals. I leave that up to him. It's kind of his wheelhouse. And I do the vegetable production on the farm. I just got my seed order in from various seed companies, and I'm ready to get things started and going. But you know, we still have this beautiful snow cover on the ground.
Do you know that Lana raises at least 30 varieties of tomatoes every summer?
I'm working on it. It's kind of an addiction.
I'm right there with you, Lana. I'm like, what new tomato can I try this year? What new tomato can I like grow this year? So
and you have an audience. You can slice it up and put it on your breakfast plate. And when a guest comes in and visits, that's a good thing to be able to tell to show them.
Absolutely, yeah. I really. I think that has also helped me get a little bit more creative on what I serve for breakfast. You know, I just look at what I have available that we grow on the farm. And, I started incorporating, you know, a fresh green salad into breakfast. The French often do it. They often do a frisé salad with an egg in the morning or something like that. And I'm like, that's perfectly fine for our, you know, bed and breakfast guests as well. And people are love it. Like they love when they just get this like bright, fresh greens. And I just do, you know, a simple lemon vinaigrette on it that, you know, it's a nice, like, acidic touch to, say, our quiche or something like that, that is very rich and filling. You know, it's just like, oh, that's a nice palate cleanser, like, to have on the side.
Does that mean you're growing frisée in the garden this summer?
I am going to grow some frisée this summer, yes. I did some last year, and then I didn't plant nearly enough of it, so I'm going to do more this year. But
no such thing as too much frisée in my book, right?
Neither for me. So
frisée is this really interesting looking. Is it in the endive family, basically?
Yeah, chicory. Yeah, in the chicory family. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's slightly bitter, but it's it's like fluffy and beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's nice to have a fluffy vegetable. Yeah, it is. Good. Well, do you have any new plans for your future? You see yourself staying on the farm for a while?
So no new plans so far. I'm enjoying being able to do what I do here. It's really nice to be able to, you know, help my family and support my family in their business, and it's a really good creative outlet for me right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just the flexibility that I have to, you know, still be able to travel and do the things I like to do, and get inspiration from, you know, places I've been, around the world. So, you know, I'm good right now.
Oh, great. Well, when you do have another trip planned, is there a restaurant or a city or that you plan on heading out to?
I will forever, until I actually go, want to go to Tokyo, to Japan.
Yes,
food scene there is that's definitely a bucket list trip. But might be doing a trip this summer with a few friends of mine to Sicily. Really want to, you know,
fun.
See that. You know,
oh, Peter, at your age, go. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Go. Yeah. I recently read that tipping in Japan is frowned upon, so make a note of that.
There we go. There we go. Yeah.
Well, it's we love having you be here in Iowa, so be sure to come back home and tell us about all of the things that you see while you're out traveling around.
Good. Thank you for being with us today. And can you give us the contact information for the Loya's Little House Bed and Breakfast?
Sure. So it's Loya's Little House Bed and Breakfast. You can find us right.
That's LOYA apostrophe S.
Yeah, LOYA apostrophe S.
Mm-hmm.
Contact us at Loya's BNB, LOYASBNB @gmail.com. And, you know, look us up. If you're in town, we're always happy for people to come out, shoot us a message.
And it's a wonderful setting for weddings and events and family reunions and things like that.
Good.
Absolutely, yeah. So,
good.
You know, we're always happy to check us for people to stop by and visit. And we love showing the house. So, come find us.
Good. Thank you for being with us today. We've been talking to Peter Beekler, fine person to talk to about the restaurant business, and now at his B&B outside of Ames. Thanks for joining us at our kitchen table today. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We can be found here at KHOI Community Radio, and also
we have a podcast.
Have at it.
Yeah, wherever you listen to podcasts, you just... If you type in Donna Lana, one word, DonnaLonna, kitchen, and there we will be.
Support this fine radio station, and you can find out more about us at khoifm.org. We've got a web page there. Well, you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live at noon every Tuesday and repeated Tuesday night on this fine radio station at 7 p.m. Support this fine radio station. We have music today by the Barn Owl Band. Happy St. Patrick's Day. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.